interrupting the current neo-Ukrainian, climate-challenged, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism to bring you behind the woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting Episode BTWRLM 642. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport. Totally different than free dumb. So get you behind the woodshed. No one else will. It's only for you to do. And for your little ones, if you have them. I'd like to pick up where I did. I ended off last episode. It was 641 relative to the interplay going on with Russia and the United States. In a way, this is a bit of historic time, so I wanted to cover this a bit. An article is now going to be about 2 weeks old. It came about a week after I had mentioned the same type of thing going on, why it was important. And it's a much better discussion, I guess, here, more coverage that I wanted to cover. I wanted to make a record of this because I think it's very important for us to understand. And so because I think we're getting more and more promotion coming out that none of it's substantive, and there's real problems underneath this if it goes wrong. And we hear lots of statements. In fact, it scared me to death, if you will, if you please, that Trump said that World War III nuclear war was off the table. I don't believe that. That's not really how this is going to work. He's just trying, I don't know why he even said that, especially the week after he sends reports to send two nuclear subs closer into Russia. So understanding on the dynamic here between the two parties, the powers actually, is very, very important. As I said last week, going out of the broadcast, these two powers have the ability to destroy the Earth. Each one has the ability to destroy the Earth with their nuclear weapons. So I'm just going to continue on to that topic. Those of you that go listening through, as some of you do, you might be able to hear the continuity this week between the two episodes. Why Putin and Trump had to talk in person. History shows summits rarely change the world, but this one might prevent disaster. The meeting between the presidents of Russia and the United States in Alaska is not an end point, but the beginning of a long journey. It will not restore the resolve, the turbulence that has gripped humanity, but it matters to everyone. In international politics, there have been few moments when meetings between leaders of major powers have decided questions of universal importance. This is partly because situations requiring attention at such a level are rare. We are living through one now. Since the start of Russia's military operation against Ukraine, Washington has declared its aim to be the strategic defeat of Russia, while Moscow has challenged the West's monopoly over world affairs. Another reason is practical. Leaders of the world's most powerful states do not waste time on problems that can be solved by subordinates. And history shows that even when top-level meetings do occur, they rarely change the overall course of international politics. It is no surprise, then, that the Alaska meeting has been compared to famous encounters from the past, notably the 1807 meeting between the Russian and French emperors on a raft in the Niemen River. That summit did not prevent Napoleon from attacking Russia 5 years later, an act that ultimately brought about his own downfall. Later, at the 1815 Congress of Vienna, Russia was the only power represented by its ruler on a regular basis. Tsar Alexander I insisted on presenting his personal vision for Europe's political structure. It failed to win over the other great powers who, as Henry Kissinger once noted, preferred to discuss interests rather than ideals. History is full of high-level talks that preceded war rather than preventing it. European monarchs would meet, fail to agree, and then march their armies. Once the fighting ended, their envoys would sit down to negotiate. Everyone understood that, quote, eternal peace, close quote, was usually just a pause before the next conflict. The 2021 Geneva summit between Russia and the U.S. may well be remembered in this way, as a meeting that took place on the eve of confrontation. Both sides left convinced their disputes could not be resolved at the time. In its aftermath, Kiev was armed, sanctions readied, and Moscow accelerated military technical preparations. Russia's own history offers parallels. The most famous summit of ancient Rus was the 1971 meeting between Prince Sviatoslav and the Byzantine Emperor. According to historian Nikolai Karamanin, they partied as friends, but that did not stop the Byzantines from unleashing the Peknigs against Sviatoslav on his journey home. In Asia, traditions were different. The status of Chinese and Japanese emperors did not permit meetings with equals. Such encounters were legally and culturally impossible. When the modern European world order was created, most famously in the 1648 Peace of Westphalia, it was not through grand encounters of rulers, but through years of negotiations among hundreds of envoys. By then, after 30 years of war, all sides were too exhausted to continue fighting. That exhaustion made it possible to agree on a comprehensive set of rules for relations between states. Seen in this historic light, top-level summits are exceedingly rare, and those that produce fundamental change are rarer still. The tradition of two leaders speaking on behalf of the entire global system is a product of the Cold War, when Moscow and Washington alone had the ability to destroy or save the world. Even if Roman and Chinese emperors had met in the 3rd century, it would not have transformed the fate of the world. The great empires of antiquity could not conquer the planet in a single war with each other, Russia as the USSR before it, and the United States can. In the last 3 years, they have often stood on the brink of a path from which there would be no return. This is why Alaska matters, even if it does not yield a breakthrough. Summits of this kind are a creation of the nuclear age. They cannot be treated just as another bilateral meeting between important states. The very fact of direct negotiations is a measure of how close or how far we are from catastrophe. The United States will arrive at the summit as a leader of the Western Bloc, whose members, even nuclear powers such as Britain and France, defer to Washington on strategic questions. Russia, for its part, will be watched closely by what is often called the global majority, dozens of states across Asia, Africa, and Latin America that resent Western dominance but cannot overturn it alone. These countries know that the U.S. mediation in local conflicts will not change the fact that the structure of the dominance remains unjust. Could Alaska lay the foundation for a new international order? Probably not. The very concept of a fixed order is fading. Any order requires an enforcing power, and none exists today. The world is moving toward greater fluidity, to the frustration of those who crave neat arrangements and predictable futures. Even if a new balance of power emerges, it will not come from one meeting. The wartime summits of Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin are not a fair comparison. Those were preceded by the most destructive battles in human history. Fortunately, we are not in that situation now. The likely outcome in Alaska is at the start of a long and difficult process rather than an immediate settlement. But it is still of fundamental importance. In today's world, only two states possess vast nuclear arsenals capable of ending human civilization. This alone means that the leaders of Russia and the United States have no more important duty than to speak directly to one another, especially when they are, for now, the only invincible powers at the edge of the world. And despite the importance of this meeting, described as Western media as a thrown curveball at the summit to Putin, using the children as fodder, First Lady Melania Trump's peace letter to Putin, it is time. Fox News Digital exclusively obtained a copy of First Lady's peace letter to Putin, which you can get the link in the broadcaster, or at any of the syndicated videos that Sound does, and the accounts that are out there in the link trees. Exclusive, they've claimed at the time, First Lady Melania Trump wrote a peace letter to Russia President Vladimir Putin, telling him it is a time to protect children and future generations around the globe. So for those of my listener behind the woodshed, you've heard me talk this terminology. You see it's being invoked. This is the terminology of sustainability. It's ingrained in people. And I don't even know if people understand this. But this is the thought process that's been captured. The mind has been captured by these terms that are being used. Here you have the warm and fuzzy trying to be thrown on someone as eminent as Putin and what decisions he has to make. The peace letter was penned by the First Lady to Putin, which President Trump hand-delivered to the Russian leader before the summit in August. Immediately upon receiving the letter, Putin read it as the American and Russian delegations looked on. Quote, "Dear President Putin," the First Lady's letter begins, "every child shares the same quiet dreams in their heart, whether born randomly into a nation's rustic countryside or a magnificent city center. They dream of love, possibility, and safety from danger. Mr. Putin, you can single-handedly restore their melodic laughter," the First Lady wrote, "in protecting the innocence of these children. You will do more than serve Russia alone. You serve humanity itself. Such a bold idea transcends all human division, and you, Mr. Putin, are fit to implement this vision with a stroke of the pen today," she wrote. "It is time." Ms. Trump's peace letter was written ahead of her historic husband, her husband's historic meeting with Putin in Anchorage, Alaska. And for a bit more context, because the letter contains mostly abstraction, speaking in non-specific allusion, no details, and using sloganeering, not heartfelt emotion, more of a political performance pitch, she didn't spell out what she is talking about. Maybe a secret between her and Putin. So we're left to guess that she's speaking to some sort of event in the Ukraine. Critics have widely blamed Putin's leadership for the abductions, and in 2020, the United Nations Human Rights Office indicted him on war crimes charges related to the allegations, is what the story tries to explain, and the Kremlin claims it has taken Ukrainian children to protect them from the conflict. And anybody who does it, I'll leave it ever up to you to do the research on what you think is going on. It's been found that a lot of those children, some of them weren't even taken. Some of them returned. A lot of them were returned if they wanted to. And they were, in fact, taken out of a place that Ukraine was attacking, the cities and towns that Ukraine was attacking at the time. And so we guess that that's what she's talking about. But this was handed to him at the start of that summit meeting. And we look around with the study of that of so-called children, and there's no actual evidence of abductions, and the complaints of Ukraine were found out to be fully error-filled or outright lies. And I don't know what I really felt about this letter. I wanted to respond to her about it, but there's just so much that's actually not good about this letter. It was a really bad fielded, a bad played pitch that I don't think should have been done myself, but that's what they did. And again, the Slovenian-born First Lady gets taken behind a woodshed and told a thing or two by a 16-year-old on that peace letter. The Gonks girl blames Zelensky for children's death in letter to U.S. First Lady. Fiona Savankova, a girl from Russia's Lugansk, who has been living under Ukrainian shelling for over a decade, said in a letter to U.S. First Lady Melania Trump that Volodymyr Zelensky was to blame for the deaths of the children in the region and asked the president's wife to help restore the killings. Quote, "My name is Fiona Savankova. I am one of those children of war that you write about in your letter to Russian President Vladimir Putin. I know that you, like Russian President Vladimir Putin and U.S. President Donald Trump, want us to have a peace and children to no longer fall asleep praying that they will wake up in the morning. But as a child who has been living under the fire by the Ukrainian army for 11 years now, I want to tell you that you should appeal to Volodymyr Zelensky first and foremost to stop the war and save the children in Donbas and Ukraine," the letter reads. "Children in Donbas continue to die because of the conflict unleashed by Europe and former U.S. President Joe Biden," the girl said. Back in 2021, Savankova recorded a video message to the United Nations calling for it to uphold the right of Donbas children to a peaceful life. That appeal landed her and her relatives on the notorious blacklist run by the Ukrainian website Voritz. in quotes, what that means is peacekeeper, which publishes personal details of enemies of Ukraine. She said she has been receiving threats since then. Quote, this website has published personal data of nearly 400 children who are also in danger. Zelensky could shut down this website with a single stroke of his pen and give these children their peaceful lives back, but he still has not done so. You can help ensure Ukraine complies not only with international law, but also with its own laws and protect children from criminals. I believe that this is your power, the letter says. Savinkova said the children of Donbas have been struggling, quote, to survive under Ukrainian shelling for too long, close quote, and asked Melania to help them see a peaceful sky above their heads. On Sunday, President Donald Trump posted Melania's letter to Russian President Vladimir Putin, in which she called for the protection of the children. So it sounds like Viana Savinkova hit the curveball thrown at Putin out of the park. It seems the absentee First Lady was just schooled on the realities of Ukraine, like her husband, President Trump, at the summit, as I was explaining, I thought, and I think happened, why it was important that Putin meet Trump face to face. But apparently, politics and the truth don't mix. This letter, Melania, and what that was intended to do, and even a child can see that. And because of that errant, politically charged pitch, visit to Alaska was timely and very useful, says Putin. No effect. On Friday, Putin and Trump met in Anchorage, Alaska for a 3-on-3 format talk that lasted 2 hours and 45 minutes. Russian President Vladimir Putin on Saturday described his trip to Alaska to meet the U.S. President Donald Trump as timely and very useful. Quote, I want to immediately note that the visit was timely and very useful, Putin said during a meeting following the Russian summit. The highlights of that speech were that the visit to Alaska was timely and very useful. They're repeating this in this story. This is a Russian publication. Take these not as me repeating over and over. They're repeating this because they're driving home a point. And this is, again, we're back to this diplomatic interaction that has to go on because the world is at stake. This is just not idle talk and idle repetition, at least as I understand it, and all the times I've looked at diplomatic interactions. Again, I'm not even a novice, just looking and watching and paying attention to at least the communications of people generally. And again, these rare instances are things you pay attention to. So it's to Russia, it was timely and useful. What that was, we don't know. But they want to convey that there was not a waste of time to another side that has a cherry red button they can push. Because he feels wrong. Because he feels wrong because he's angry. He doesn't like something, this other guy. And so this is it can be walking on eggshells a little bit in this. But some other highlights were that he had an opportunity to calmly and thoroughly outline Russia's position in Alaska to Trump. Russia wants to see fighting in Ukraine end. And Russia would like to move to resolving all issues by peaceful matters. And when you see the word all there, you do have to do the research to find what all Russia has been talking about, what all the United States was completely ignoring and dismissing in Russia. And Putin decided he needed to do the face-to-face to make sure that he knew that Trump knew what these issues were. Eliminating these root causes should be the basis for the resolution, said the president during a meeting following the Russian-U.S. summit. Putin mentioned that during his talks with U.S. President Donald Trump in Alaska, they discussed a possible resolution to the Ukrainian crisis based on fairness. He noted that the summit provided an opportunity to calmly and thoroughly present Russia's position. You heard me in prior episodes speak. This is what Putin did with Tucker Carlson. He took a lot of time to set up the history so people understood a context within which Russia makes its decisions. Putin and their leadership make their decisions. What the people of Russia have been through. and what they view us to be completely disregarding or not even know it. And Tucker Carlson admitted he didn't know, to hit for his part. And so this is very important to Putin. And I think it's very important for people to understand the basics, and why I go through all this and talk about it. When you're looking at someone else who can hurt you, and they think that you're trespassing upon them, or they're protecting someone else, you better be able to hear what they're saying. It's not going to go well to not. And in this case, Russia is fully capable of protecting itself and those people in Ukraine. And so it doesn't look good if people stop dialogue on this, even at the speed of diplomacy. Putin noted that the summit provided an opportunity to calmly and thoroughly represent Russia's position directly to Trump, not through intermediaries, couriers, or whoever, best friends, buddies, whatever, directly, right across the table, if not shaking hands and talking, right, maybe that 10 minutes in the beast, traveling together. Quote, we haven't had direct negotiation of this kind at this level for a long time. I repeat, it was an opportunity to calmly and thoroughly outline our position once again, Putin said during the meeting. And this is the other thing I keep pointing out. The things that Russia is saying have not changed. And they've been saying these things since before the beginning, and then clearly right after, as I was educated. I didn't quite hear the words before that they were saying. Didn't understand the meaning of them to the Russian people or the Russian government. And when it was more clearly explained after the, particularly I think it was the sanctions, I came back and told you I was mistaken. I misinterpreted the intention of these words. But here is what you need to really be listening, that at least I think you need to be listening to. And that part, that adjustment in me has not changed now. And it's consistent with what Putin's still seeing is not happening for Russia in this very important matter between two, and yeah, there's a lot of players, yeah, the UK's out there, but between two powers that could literally end life as we know it on the face of the earth. And we haven't had these negotiations. We have to have them. This is serious stuff. Trump doesn't get it. It may not be Trump's fault. I've had to make sure that I know Trump knows. We're going to get rid of the string and the tin can, the smoke signals, and we're going to get rid of the couriers and whatever all else has been in between us. The conversation was very open and substantive, and in my opinion, it brings us closer to the necessary decisions, Putin said. We discussed practically all areas of interaction with the U.S., President Donald Trump, Putin said. Russia would like to resolve all issues concerning Ukraine through peaceful means. Quote, I will now give you a detailed account of the entire conversation, and if there are any questions, I will gladly answer them, he added. In his discussion where he was at the time. Of course, we respect the position of the United States administration, which sees the need for an immediate cessation of hostilities. That's a diplomatic statement. Yes, the United States, we see and we hear you. We will deal with those. We're not listening. Very important statement right there, as you have the Trump administration and Trump saying that he was angry at Putin, when Putin was just telling him again what he had been saying before. But I don't think Trump understood it. And so he got slighted when Trump's perception of what he thought he heard was not what Putin did, which was exactly what he's been saying. And that's the other episode I told you. This is a very serious problem. This is a big disconnect that's got to be fixed. Putin saw that. Certainly well before I get it behind which had to tell you. I can only imagine some of the thoughts that they have in just lots of people that are looking at wanting to see the peace and how it's not working, how close this is all coming to disconnecting terribly. And then what do we do? How do we continue the engagement? You watched a pretty successful re-engagement in what happened in Alaska. Even if Witkoff didn't have a clue what he was doing, it was used to have this meeting. And I'll say for myself. And we also want this. We would like to move towards resolving all issues through peaceful means, he concluded. Again, reinforcing over and over that they're there to be worked with together to resolve the issues for peaceful outcomes it, all issues, not just this or that. Remember, this was an economic summit, actually, when you get looked down to it. Ukraine was a little part of it. And they all came away fairly well. Now, subsequently, we're having a little bit of trouble, but that's the diplomacy thing. What you want to continue to see is they're working together. They're at least talking together. Even if Trump doesn't get what he wants. And I'm watching the adjustments being made. So that, for Trump's part, he may not put himself in that capacity where he's angry because Putin doesn't do what he expected. But he listens more carefully. And he can almost predict what Putin will be doing. And that's not changing at all. He may not like what Putin's doing, but it's not to slight him, Trump. It's not to slight the President of the United States. It's not to be obstinate. So things went pretty much as I suspected that they would there, as you was told, behind the woodshed. There was really nothing new. And in a way, that's the shame of it. I think, though, Trump finally heard exactly what it's going to take. And that there will be no negotiations upon eliminating the root causes. Those are set in gold, if you will. We're talking about gold and Trump. Yeah, it's set in gold. Those things aren't moving anywhere. And that there will be no negotiations upon eliminating the root causes to an agreement, but will be to solve those root causes, which are the basis, the very foundation from which any agreement will be built. And I think that Putin is satisfied that Trump has finally gotten that memo. And why I said this summit was shameful in one regard, that memo wasn't a secret. It's the same memo Russia has been trying to get everyone to read and peacefully respond to. It's the same memo we got behind the woodshed 1 week after the special operation started, as Russia deemed NATO and Western expansion 1 inch east while murdering the people of Donbass was an existential threat to them, and by their intention under international law, Russia. But Trump is a bit of a hardhead about laws, conditions, or he says that he doesn't know about, and problems, doesn't want to know about them either, that all y'all behind the woodshed knew years ago, that didn't take an expensive summit to finally get the memo to inform Trump. And I think that post-meeting photo at the podium shown Trump realizes he has no cards and has no deal to make except to help eliminate the root causes Russia got involved in that has been caused by the United States interference, by coup d'etat, overthrowing a democratically elected government of Ukraine, the government of which eventually installs Pinocchio Linsky. So now that Trump is exposed to have no cards to deal with, the ball is in Trump's court because we ain't playing poker no more. And in this delicate moment, NATO agency should not be responding to a thing. But we hear it in the news. Security guarantees would be an interesting phrase for you to keep up with. It doesn't mean what it's saying, but at any rate, we'll go with it. Security guarantees for Ukraine do not require deployment of U.S. troops, U.S. NATO envoy says. Potential security guarantees for Ukraine may not require the deployment of U.S. may not require, I'll say that again, may not require the deployment of U.S. troops and are expected to be primarily focused on a command and control role, U.S. Ambassador to NATO Matthew Whitaker stated on Monday. Well, that's up for President Donald Trump to determine. A lot of it could be command and control. Doesn't necessarily need to be American troops. But at the same time, obviously, Ukraine and the European countries would love the United States to be involved in some way that, you know, I don't expect, but we'll see, Whitaker told Fox News when asked what the role the U.S. would play in the security guarantees for Ukraine. Quote, and so, if they, the Ukrainians, want to achieve a lasting peace, they understand that they will need a security system, and it will be provided and financed by the Europeans, Whitaker emphasized. So, Russia's And you'll see it in there as you look around. Russia's not going to agree to any NATO involvement if Russia is going to be true to its core issues that it needs resolved. NATO agency responding is the exactly wrong engagement to make by the United States. It anticipates Trump isn't serious about peace in Ukraine more than cutting and running from the criminal enterprise the United States aids and abets. That Trump can say peace all he wants. But as long as the U.S. condones further interference by the West, Trump intends no peace. In fact, the Ukrainian security guarantees facade will continue war, but the United States won't be paying for it. The Europeans will, which Trump thinks is beautiful for American and military industrial biotech rackets. War with Russia, killing Russians to the last Ukrainian, is a terrific deal, as long as Trump isn't paying for it. And there's no pressure on Trump to deal further with it. The pressure is off him at this point. And he can live at peace in that. He's the peacemaker. But remember, peace was made long prior. But Euro-delinquent Boris Johnson, of a NATO member, a United Kingdom convinced Pinocchio Linsky, whom was not illegitimate at the time, to abandon that peace agreed to by Russia in 2022 in the Istanbul communique and draft peace agreement. NATO sabotaging peace. The U.S. is the predominant part of NATO. And after the 2014 Minsk ceasefire agreements with, if I remember correctly, United Nations Security Council agreement that was later admitted by the West by Merkel to Holland to be a ruse to trick Russia, bringing us here today. And Trump talks like he's never heard of any of this, but that for him, peace is impossible. When all he has to do is get out the way and take NATO with him, if peace is his objective. This isn't such a hard deal, actually, especially with Trump's setting up. But you see the lingering problem. And Russia's fully cognizant of this problem. And we can see about where things actually are, and that Russia is ultimately in the driver's seat for any cessation of hostilities as it protects the people of the Donbas from Western and Ukraine aggression started by the United States interference in Ukraine, culminating in that coup d'etat of the Ukraine government 2014, right? Un-Victoria, new land. Lavrov, Russia demands equal role in Ukraine security guarantees. So they see the train running, the rail running right off the rails already. The European kings, as you hear the article I read before, in the past, running it off. It's never going to go anywhere. They're going to get their armies up and come after Russia when this doesn't work. Russia's seen it before. They need to stop it. They need to nip this in the bud. So they come right up with their foreign minister to say so. That Russia feels it has to say that is an embarrassment of the West, in particular, the European NATO interloper. Russia has reiterated that any security guarantees for Ukraine must be negotiated on an equal basis with the participation of major powers, including China, the United States, the United Kingdom, and France, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said. You see how big this is? You see how big the problem is if it goes south? It's global. And Russia's saying, we need everybody involved this time in all of it. Anybody that essentially is that nuclear power condition. Key statements by the Russian foreign minister, Russia sees growing U.S. recognition of the need to address root causes of the crisis. So they throw out and remind the United States what everyone's there for, actually. Russia insists the European collective guarantees for Ukraine must be truly reliable. Remember, Putin said to Trump, we need a just outcome here, a fair outcome here. Focus should remain on developments from the 2022 Istanbul negotiations of Ukraine security. You see, they refer back to when it was almost successful. Everybody did almost agree, except for the Ukraine's buffoon stepping in. Moscow will also provide guarantees for Ukraine. No security framework without Russia. Such talks lead to nowhere, is Lavrov's message to the West. And so they're here right again. It's being trying to be taken off the rails of where it could go. And we're watching that very first content I read come to fruition as the kings of Europe are trying to derail this so they can go to war. It's almost written into their DNA, it seems. And Russia's seen this. This is not something Russia hasn't seen. They've been here. They've been there and done that. And I would ask that you consider my opinion on this, my observations on this. This is not Russian-centric. This is international law, how nations need to interact with each other when there's an interference. And in this case, to the point of an existential threat. And then for us today, the nuclear threat. The globally relative and relevant threat. And Lavrov correctly assesses the U.S., that Trump now agrees, EU leaders try to hinder Russia, U.S. dialogue, Putin's special economic envoy states. Kirill Dmitriev quoted U.S. media saying that what Europe believes that the peace talks on Ukraine are allegedly doomed to collapse. European leaders are doing everything they can to obstruct the Ukraine peace talks and the restoration of Russia. U.S. relations, Kirill Dmitriev, head of Russia Direct Investment Fund and special presidential representative for investment and economic cooperation with foreign countries, wrote on Telegram. Fascinating where they're writing this stuff. Dmitriev added that the European leaders do so hiding behind statements about distrust toward Russia. The official earlier quoted U.S. President Donald Trump as praising his good relationship with Russian President Vladimir Putin. According to Trump, the U.S. would be in danger without mutual understanding with Putin. So maybe she was premature and now is time to roll out Victoria Nuland's 2014 reported statement to F**k the EU. Because the EU is irrelevant to what Russia needs except to its psychopathic need to trespass upon Russia like Hitler before them. If the EU wants security guarantees, it can disestablish NATO and build the guarantees it needs and can pay for without interfering with others. And who else do we know that Trump doesn't expect peace? Who he is an associate member with has just required war. Remember, Podolyansky is illegitimate in the eyes of Russia, and it can make no agreement with someone it deems an illegitimate representative of the Ukraine. The certainty for war is baked in the martial law created by the Ukrainian parliament. Britain will help Ukraine hold post-war elections. Post-war elections means Russia will have no one until after the special operations concludes that it deems legitimate to make a peace agreement with. Unless something changes in this regard, there is no path to peace for want of a legitimate head of state for the Ukraine. Britain will help Ukraine conduct its first elections after the war with Russia. A new memorandum signed between British and Ukrainian Electoral Commission outlines cooperation to improve Ukraine's democratic practices, including assistance with voting from abroad and combating disinformation. Ukraine has been under martial law since Russia's 2022 invasion, preventing elections. The pact aims to strengthen democratic values and prepares for challenging post-war elections. So if Britain can handle the voting from abroad, from Ukraine's feeling Ukraine now valid, then is Zelensky's excuse that voting can't be done during the war because of all the people that left. Sounds like the war is just a pretext to keep the illegitimate dictator-in-chief in place. Peace is not the objective, and Trump knows that. It's likely why he's trying to put some distance between him and Europe, but hypocritically only so far as weapons can still be shipped from the United States because Europe pays for them, but not so far to remove the U.S. from NATO, though Trump has threatened to, all of which is not conducive to making peace, especially when you have no cards. As we try to look through and make sense of things that absolutely make no sense. Again, if you wanted peace, you'd be making peace. And there's every excuse that they're not. Yeah. And there's not. So who's ready to die? In Europe. In NATO. United States. Who's ready to die for Kiev? Experts debunks West empty promises on Ukraine security guarantees. American University of Paris Professor Hal Gardner warns that NATO and EU security pledges are wishful thinking and calls for a new approach in involving Russia. In a candid interview with Sputnik, Professor Hal Gardner, chair of the Department of International Comparative Politics at the American University of Paris, systematically dismantled the feasibility of Western security proposals currently being advanced in diplomatic circles. Well, behind the choreography displayed in Washington meetings, the collective West on one side and Russia on the other, there is little substance, said Gardner. The question that remains unanswered is, who is ready to die for Kiev? The illusion of security guarantees, Professor Gardner highlighted, several fundamental flaws in the Western approach. NATO Article 5 is wishful thinking, extending the Alliance Mutual Defense Clause to Ukraine is politically untenable, even within the United States. EU Article 42.7 is dead on arrival. While the EU treaty offers a form of collective security, it explicitly refers to NATO, N-A-T-O, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, making it unacceptable to Russia. Under the UN Security Council, sending troops to Ukraine to guarantee security is a formula that can be conceived only under UN Security Council resolution requesting it and fixing its rules of engagement. Such a perspective is currently very much hypothetical. Well, Russia will not accept any involvement in NATO as an organization and will not tolerate armed forces from any NATO country, Gardner emphasized. Please, stop me if you haven't heard lots of people saying the very same thing, even the guy behind Woodship. Again, someone else looking in, someone who's papered, saying the exact same thing. This was not a secret. How Trump doesn't know is a shock. And I don't know that he doesn't know. The only viable path. So get this now. The only viable path. A new European security architecture. Rather than recycle failed models, Gardner proposes a realistic, if politically difficult, alternative, a trilateral security framework negotiated between the EU, the US, and Russia. Can I just interject? The guy behind the woodshed said get rid of NATO and restructure your defense package for Europe. This is not a hard deal, actually, if Trump wanted to make peace. Quote, the only option that may have some credibility is a declaration demanding the reconstruction of the long-term collective European security architecture, he explained. Such a process would be promoted by the EU in a trilateral dialogue with the US and Russia. My question is, why did you go to the EU unless it's just a promotion? The European nation leaders need to do this. The EU needs to not do a thing. Get out. Put it back in its box, too. Within this new system, Ukraine, as an EU candidate country, could be granted credible security assurances without triggering escalation with Moscow. I would have to interject again there. Why don't we listen from what they have to say and not put a conjectural statement out for that. But at least this is a different plan that does have some legs if they would just do it, and peace could be the result. Empty promises and real consequences. Gardner warns that continuing to offer Ukraine security guarantees that cannot be implemented does more than mislead. it prolongs suffering and instability. Quote, despite efforts to show unity between Europe and the U.S., deep differences remain about what concrete availability each country would be capable of and is willing to offer to Ukraine, he concluded. And we now get the information. Who will die for Ukraine? Well, they're gonna die. Die they will. 1.7 million losses exposed after Russian hackers cracked Ukrainian General Staff database. So as Europe is deciding this, and NATO and United States on who's going to die, understand the losses are immense. The Killnet group hacked the Ukrainian General Staff database containing information on 1.7 million killed and missing Ukrainian servicemen. The hackers also shared a number of photos of deceased Ukrainian soldiers, their passports and military IDs, death and tags. And all that you can see in the article when you download the link from the broadcaster or watch the syndicated video simulcast Sound Minds curates for this network, if you will. I won't read more of that. You can see it's sitting there, the information. You can now go back and test the veracity of the two nations telling us who, how many have died. And Russia's really tight-lipped, so I don't know if we're going to find out that many, but if 1.7 million have died in Ukraine, even though they said, I've seen reports as low as only a couple hundred thousand, but 1.7, now they did say missing, but let's just go with it for the time, just to have a number, 1.7 million, they said that losses of Russia were 10%, and there has been some evidence that that number's about right. Now, I'm not going to, can't prove it, but it sure looks like in certain numbers it did look viable. So look at the amount of people here that have died. All because of what? U.S. interference? The bloodlust of Europe to go as neo-Nazis at Russia? Remember, eliminating neo-Nazis in Ukraine is what Europe, European countries and NATO is protecting in Ukraine. So let's get our mind wrapped around this nonsense on top of it all. Because it starts to come back. It starts to haunt us as this week went on. It was pretty amazing. Again, my interest in this is to show us this literally historic interaction going on that at this level and stage of advancement of so-called mankind, so-called advancement of mankind, we are at the brink. We are at the brink of the ability and at the ability and capability of a nuclear catastrophe. And the two parties that are now having a trouble. And we can hear about the disagreement with NATO, NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, involvement immediately from Russia when they start piping up. Again, remember, Russia has been repeating this over and over. And I know it sounds boring, oh, they just repeat themselves. Yeah, you realize they repeat themselves and still no one listens. Not no one. You understand what I'm saying. Those that count are not listening. And beginning the broadcast, Russia, Putin decided, I need to see Trump. I need to know the guy knows. This is just so ridiculous. Is he really this absent? And you saw after that meeting, Trump started to change. He started making different decisions. They still have their problems with how they're going to soft shoe this, softball pitch it, sneak them way out. But Trump now realizes he can't justify, in the end, he can't justify what he thought he was going to try and do at all. And he does not have a card to play. And he cannot bluff that he has a card to play. NATO deployment in Ukraine unacceptable. Moscow says. This statement is just another restatement of the same fact that's been going on that the EU leaders and Madman Macron and all the other ones, all these names you can come up with, and even Trump have been saying they want to allow, even by not talking about it, allow NATO to be viable. That is one of the very first things that's not happening. It's what causes this whole thing, is that NATO is involved. Foreign Minister spokeswoman Maria Zakharova has accused the UK of undermining Russia-US diplomatic efforts. Sergei Shoigu Secretary of Russia's National Security Council and former defense minister earlier warned that the arrival of NATO troops in Ukraine can trigger a third world war. Please, I mean, just interject. I hope you're saying the same thing my mind is. This is not hyperbole, what they're talking and telling us. Putin admitted to it. Trump admitted to it. We're at that break, or we could be even closer, if not over the edge, in just a very quick and short time. One misunderstanding. In March, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and the French President Emmanuel Madman Macron announced the establishment of a coalition of the willing to provide, these people aren't even original either, coalition of the willing to provide ground and air forces to monitor a potential truce or a peace deal should Kiev and Moscow reach one. Just think about that. They're not reaching one, okay? So this whole thing is actually a bunch of wasted words, actually. But let's read on, because this is what's in their mind. This is how this is not going to work, actually. This is why Trump is cutting them out. It's why the red carpet was given to Putin and not all the other European leaders when they went to the White House just after with Zelensky. Germany, Poland, Spain, Italy, Romania, and Croatia have all refused to commit their military personnel. Earlier this month, the Sunday Times quoted an anonymous UK defense official as saying that no one wants to send their troops to die in Ukraine. Well, apparently your sons and daughters will die in Ukraine, and Europe too, if these nuclear-armed Nazi-esque psychopaths have their way inventing phantoms to fulfill their nightmares for you. And we have on this overarching condition and the other war going on against Europe by the United States. We have an update on the Nord Stream pipeline destruction, claiming an arrest of a character in an implausible storyline called Operation Diameter. 7-man group behind Nord Stream attack, Italian media. Russia and numerous experts have said the idea that the bombing was carried out by a small unit is improbable. Italian media has released what they claim to be more details of the investigation into the Nord Stream pipeline bombing, alleging it was executed by a former Ukrainian serviceman and 6 accomplices. Nord Stream, which carried Russian natural gas to Germany and Western Europe via the Baltic Sea, was sabotaged in September 2022 by underwater explosions near Denmark's Bornholm Island. Moscow has dismissed as ridiculous the theory that a small group could have carried out the attack. Swedish engineer Eric Anderson, who led the first and only independent forensic probe at the blast sites, previously told an Italian journalist that the entire divers on a boat story was a clear mission to whitewash the USA and other Western nations for their possible part in the sabotage. Quote, the more I look into this, the more I feel that a Nord Stream attack is just as a part of a bigger scheme to cut off Russia from Europe, he said. Italian media have released what they claim to be more details of the investigation into Nord Stream pipeline bombing, alleging it was executed by a former Ukrainian serviceman and 6 accomplices. Former. I guess he could be a mercenary, couldn't he? In a long since past episode, I've explained what I think makes this storyline implausible. For instance, that straight line cuts on the pipe indicate a military style shaped charge detonation. I'm certainly not an expert at all, but I don't think that can happen using the packages of high explosive described in the article. And the amount is just under what would likely be able to create any seismic effects that they said they claimed was going on. So, but we'll see. But going on what I think more plausible, we'll be watching those accomplices will be stepping up to continue this whitewashing? Why does the Italian media have facts and only now? Because it was never said the Italian media was doing any forensic investigation of the pipeline, or even for Italy, the government of Italy, under its mutual defense obligations potential under NATO itself. So Italy is now on the radar. If Italy wasn't, when it was reported that a or some perpetrators fled to Italy when this thing happened. In other words, as it strikes me to consider, a non-NATO member, Ukraine, attacked NATO members and NATO didn't execute its professed mandate to defend NATO members from this attack. Or that NATO members attacked other members contrary to the North Atlantic Treaty, blamed it on Pinocchio-Linsky's patsy, and NATO became a non-entity for breach of the treaty and to cover what they were all, or most, were in on it, and that this was an attack on Russia directly by NATO. Again, the whitewash. So, at this point, it doesn't matter which members actually done it. That it was done is enough. So we look at who would directly benefit. It's reported the UK has become an increasing energy exporter to Europe since then. And certainly it's also directly benefiting the United States in its goal to destroy Russia, shift energy sales to the U.S., drill baby drill, right, Trump? And cripple Europe's economy and culture as well. Oh, and then we have the neo-Nazi, the very thing Russia is on record as a core issue to extinguish in Ukraine, and that the recently admitted to NATO Finland, its President Alexander Stubb, under cover of, quote, Euro-Atlantic solidarity, quote, repackaging Hitler and Germany aiding Finland's 1944 peace treaty with Russia, reverting it through modernization adulterations, promising security guarantees, which only means perpetual war, again with Russia, promoting his goal and as the architect of the new Western security system that they're claiming that they're going to be looking at. Meaning they're building a perpetual war system. Coming out of the president of Finland is not NATO seeking peace. NATO includes and will continue to include the United States, despite what peace faker Trump feels, knows, or promotes about. So at this point, Trump's not looking too aware here in his denials. And if he knows, well, he's a great deceiver playing his role on the Mr. Global Kabuki stage masterfully, which might be a Tony or an Emmy or an Academy Award or a special place in Hades, but it's not Nobel Political Peace Prize worthy. Well, unless the prize is also neo or Zio-Nazi inspired now. Maybe if Trump starts singing a different tune, he can be a contender for a Grammy. What do you think? Could jump it back over the pond relative to the whitewashing that seems to be going on anymore under the cover of how much America is being made great again. DOJ pledges to turn over first Epstein files this week. I thought the Epstein files were a hoax. How about you? Panel's deadline was Tuesday, and Democrats say the department isn't in full compliance. The Justice Department has notified Congress that it will start releasing documents related to Jeffrey Epstein as soon as Friday, according to Republican Representative James Comer. The Kentucky Republican, who chairs a House Oversight Committee, said the DOJ committed to begin providing records to the panel had subpoenaed, and Comer cautioned that the process will take time due to the sensitive nature of material, including the need to redact information identifying victims and any child sexual abuse content. So can I just interject right here? Okay, they got victims they already know about. Why wasn't there interviews on all these to find the clients? We're not talking about the client list that was made by Epstein. We're talking about the one that was compiled through the videos and the victims after the investigation. The subpoena issued earlier this month came with a deadline of Tuesday and adds to mounting scrutiny of the Trump administration's handling of materials connected with the Epstein case. The subcommittee wants more than files. Members also are seeking documents or testimony from several people, including Bill and Hillary Clinton and multiple former attorney generals spanning both Democratic and Republican administrations. You see, the Uniparty just filters right on down through the structure of government, doesn't it? The timeline for full compliance remains unclear. Comer, in his statement, characterized the document release as a step toward transparency, echoing public calls for more information about the investigation into the disgraced financier who died in jail 2019 while facing sex trafficking charges. Are we going to see them, folks? What do you think? Transparency. So you're watching the transparency, how it's created. And another aspect coming through on that note, and having to do with another report I may get to later relative to loyalty and rewards on the live updates for NBC News. Justice Department releases Ghislaine Maxwell, what was our pronunciation on that? Releases Ghislaine Maxwell's interview transcript and audio recording. The Justice Department on Friday released transcripts of Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche's two-day interview with convicted sex trafficker and Jeffrey Epstein associate Ghislaine Maxwell. In her DOJ interview, Ghislaine Maxwell said she never witnessed Trump commit any inappropriate conduct with Epstein and added, quote, "Trump was always very cordial and very kind to me." Well, President Trump was always very cordial and very kind to me, and I just want to say that I admire his extraordinary achievement in becoming the president now. And I like him, and I've always liked him. So that's what you say, kids, when you want Trump's favor. Who taught her to do that trick with her tongue? Blanche asked Maxwell if she knew whether Epstein maintained a black book or client list containing names of famous people that he knew. Well, yeah, there's no list. We'll start with that, Maxwell said. Prodded further about the client list, Maxwell said, absolutely no, there is no list. There is no, I'm not aware of any blackmail. I never heard that. I never saw it, and I never imagined it, Maxwell said. So relative to just how this thing was reported, she jumped to blackmail of no client a little quick, didn't she? Especially the other report saying that they've got to be careful of the sensitivity of the victims. In the interview with Blanche, Maxwell expressed skepticism about the medical examiner's ruling that Epstein killed himself in August 2019. Quote, "I do not believe he died by suicide," Maxwell said. So she thinks Epstein did not kill himself. And pardon me, why would he kill himself? With friends in such high places, no clients, and nothing untoward to find. But with so much Trump flattery and perceived loyalty to reward, how is a Trump pardon not warranted, right, General Cruz? We'll hopefully get to, if you've seen this in the news. This is BTWRLM 642, and you can't go wrong when you get behind the woodshed. And if you had, you may have heard how to avoid these nonsensical things that go on in the world, all contrary to law, if you just go and read the black and white, as I've said, to protect yourself. Moving into a whole bunch of different type things now going on. After 762 cases, Texas's measles outbreak ends. State reports there hasn't been a new illness since July the 1st. The Texas measles outbreak that has sickened 760 people since late January is over. So the outbreak ended before turning into an epidemic. And again, I'll go through step by step a bit on this. Partly the only reason why I bring a lot of these stories up is to remind us there is an order in law about what was supposed to happen. And we'll find that order in lots of subject matters. But this one seems to be fairly easy to pick out. And why I certainly chose it, well, being able to predict the great COVID swindle, watching that come through, and we touch so many constitutional powers that people have. that I wanted to exercise this a bit and show this again. So remember, in your local communicable disease law, you have the health event, and it rises to the point where it becomes an outbreak, and then it moves within the health jurisdiction to an epidemic when it starts to move outside of that jurisdiction to others that are within a state. It never jumped to an epidemic in Texas. Not an outbreak. Okay, great. But health officials have not confirmed a new case in the affected counties in more than 42 days, passing the threshold used to declare measles outbreaks over. The last outbreak-related case in Texas was on July the 1st. Two young Texas children died of the virus early this year, and 100 people were hospitalized throughout the outbreak. So it's sad to hear about the deaths, but that's a 2% death rate, which is, I think, twice the rate of the great COVID swindle, if you believed in such a thing, and no pandemic. But were the two deaths caused by the vaccine? The cases were linked to outbreaks in Canada and Mexico and jumped to other states in the United States. I wonder what kept it from becoming epidemic and what stopped it. Natural immunity, maybe? Now, this case down under is dismissed, but this is as much a PSA to reconsider this vaccine. Now, this is a different one, this vaccine down under, because it's being reported that dozens and dozens of horses are dying, just as people did, injected at warp speed with the same bioweapon technology in the great COVID swindle, the same bioweapon technology that is quickly becoming ubiquitous without obstruction. Please look around where this mRNA is popping up. It's just about everywhere. Federal court dismisses horse owners' $53 million Hendra vaccine damages class action. Horse owners from New South Wales and Queensland were part of a legal class action. The federal court has dismissed an application for $53 million in damages in a class action by horse owners over alleged deaths and side effects from Hendra vaccine. The federal court has dismissed an application for the $53 million in damages by that allegation. The judge says that there was too many uncertainties. So here we go again. I'm just not talking about bad vaccines and all that or not. I'm talking about what goes on in your remedies when bad things happen to you and how we watch the system, because the people you go to typically are part of the system, tend to make problems for us. We don't get the remedies we need. The judge says too many uncertainties. Allegedly, losses of damages include reduced financial value of horses, veterinary treatment expenses, loss of income generated by the horse, loss of opportunity to gain income from the horse, and replacement value of the horse. Well, that sounds pretty cool, that list. But he says alleged. Now, I'm going to say right there, too many uncertainties. This is an evidentiary problem. This is an attorney problem. And down under, I think they might be considered, though I don't know actual system, they're solicitors. Despite the alleging of those things, the court rejected the claims. There are too many uncertainties to find the vaccine caused any serious side effects, just as Steve Rares said. Based on the expert evidence, none of the clinical signs of which the applicant relied as serious or debilitating side effects was in fact a side effect of Equivac HEV, except in respect of those that I found were transient side effects. Mr. Rivera said some of the transient side effects were lumps, hives, lethargy, and pain. So maybe y'all down under should not have filed a class action and get some lawyer or solicitor that knows how to make a solid case with proper evidence. And if you read that story through, there is someone who is building a database. And I think they have the right idea, but after the fact, that may be a need to be relied upon and people should take note of. So again, this is not just a story, oh, there's a bad vaccine. People think it's hurting. If you're going to go to court, you better bring your evidence and your direct connection causality. And you've seen the example of how the industry and government will protect itself, then the difficulties of creating the evidence would show causality. And I say, it's not to give up, it's to show you the high bar that you need and the injustice that you're facing in the justice system all over the globe, wherever rule of law and democracy runs amok, under rules that make it look like they're not. Targeting the mitochondrial stem cell connection in cancer treatment, a hybrid orthomolecular protocol. So I'm going to present this. This is more of a suggestion, and it's not much different than we've been talking behind a woodshed, or you might be finding as you look, but there's more concurrence on this protocol, that these protocols are possible and will and can work. And I can suggest, I've made suggestions to people, pass the word on, spread the word out, and I know of a couple people who have taken these types of things, they had to fine-tune them to their need, and they stopped their cancer. So this is pretty cool stuff. We're taking this in our own hands, and we're having to, on the other end, on both instances, we've had to, I understand that you have to find a doctor that will be willing to do this. But in this case, some of them in this paper were found to work. And I'm not saying this is it for you. I'm saying these are the things you might want to check if you haven't seen them before, or to confirm that you have seen them before, that this is what's been checked out. And we see mitochondrial stem cell connection, MSCC, theory suggests that cancer originates from chronic oxidative phosphorylation, or OxPhos, insufficiency in stem cells. This OxPhos insufficiency leads to the formation of cancer stem cells, or CSCs, and abnormal energy metabolism, ultimately resulting in malignancy. This concept integrates two well-established theories, the cancer stem cell theory and the metabolic theory. Drawing on insights from molecular biology, pharmacology, and clinical studies, this manuscript introduces a hybrid orthomolecular protocol targeting the MSCC. The protocol includes 7 therapeutic recommendations consisting of orthomolecules, drugs, and additional therapies. The aim of this hybrid orthomolecular protocol is to achieve additive and synergistic effects to enhance OxPhos, inhibit the primary fuels of cancer cells, glucose and glutamine, target CSCs, and metastasis. Thus, numerous experiments suggest that targeting MSCC could be a potentially therapeutic approach for cancer treatment. And I'll let you get the link to this, and we can pick up on the PDF, and I'll read the conclusion to it. You can get the link. The mitochondrial stem cell connection could be a key element in therapeutic approach to cancer. In light of current knowledge, we have selected and proposed the use of orthomolecules, drugs, and other therapies for their potential to revive cellular OxPhos activity and target CSCs, glycosis, like glutaminolysis. There are also aimed at addressing metastasis created by fusion hybridization between cancer stem cells and microphages. Numerous experiments in cell and animal and human support the role of targeting the MSCC in both the prevention and treatment of cancer. And when you see that that's what they're targeting, maybe you, in your studies, keep in mind to that, you might find other things that will also target that connection. And an update on that biobag I reported on years ago, that in trials researchers showed that the premature lambs kept in artificial wombs not only survived but put on weight and grew hair. Would you use a robot surrogate? China develops the world's first pregnancy humanoid that's capable of giving birth to a live baby. It's a concept that currently only exists in sci-fi movies. But scientists in China are developing the world's first pregnancy robot capable of carrying a baby to term and giving birth. The humanoid will be equipped with an artificial womb that receives nutrients through a hose, experts say. A prototype is expected to be released next year with a selling price of around 100,000 yuan or 10,000 pound. Dr. Zhan Qifeng, who founded the company Kawai Technology, is developing the machine. The device he envisions is not simply an incubator by a humanoid, but can replicate the entire process from conception to delivery, Asian media outlets report. He said the artificial womb technology is already in a mature stage and now needs to be implanted in the robot's abdomen so that a real person and the robot can interact to achieve pregnancy. With regards to ethical and legal issues, he said, we have held discussion forums with authorities in Guangdong province and submitted related proposals while discussing policy and legislation. But realize we have a social crisis blooming. Since the 1980s, feminist activists such as Andrea Dworkin have been strongly opposed to the use of artificial wombs on the grounds that it would lead to the end of women. In 2012, Ms. Dworkin wrote, quote, women already have the power to eliminate men, and in their collective wisdom, they have decided to keep them. The real question now is, will men, once the artificial womb is perfected, want to keep women around? Yeah, anything to promote the destruction of family and family values and the state birthing, raising, and inculcating your little lambs. With its CRISPR GMO modernization enhancements, of course. Isn't there a movie or two about the future that they want in this regard? And speaking of what the they want, BlackRock's Fink appointed as interim co-chairman of World Economic Forum. Board of WEF clears founder Schwab of material wrongdoing after investigation. BlackRock Chief Executive Larry Fink has been appointed interim co-chairman of the World Economic Forum, which organizes the annual meetings of leaders in Davos, Switzerland. Andre Hoffman, let me interject. Remember, this is the guy that said, we're not going to do those sustainable development goals no more. Yeah, no, he's still right there. He's still involved. Now he's the chairman. Andre Hoffman, the vice chair of Swiss-based healthcare company Roche Holding, will also be interim co-chairman of the WEF, according to an announcement on Friday. Quote, the world is more fragmented and complex than ever, but the need for a platform that brings together business, government, and civil society has never been greater, Mr. Fink and Mr. Hoffman said in a joint statement. If you didn't hear Soros and sustainability in that statement. We remain optimistic. The forum has an opportunity to help drive international collaboration in a way that not only generates prosperity, but distributes it more broadly. To whom? This renewed vision can promote open markets and national priorities side by side while advancing the interests of workers and stakeholders globally. Not stockholders, stakeholders. Not much more than sustainable right there. It's all I've been talking about. Well, not all I'm talking about. One of the aspects of this is all only that. Stakeholders and stalking horses. Remember that episode? And a whole bunch of episodes about this subject matter. Both Mr. Fink and Mr. Hoffman have been serving on the WEF board before being appointed to the current positions. The latest announcement comes as global economy feels the impact of geopolitical matters and the rise of protectionism fostered by the introduction of U.S. tariffs. But what's really happening? U.S. President Donald Trump shook the world economy following the April 2nd Liberation Day announcement with new tariffs. A number of leaders from world of business and politics attend the forum every year. Mr. Trump addressed the forum online this year. So this is shaken but not stirred as Trump onshored the future and is onshoring the future that they want during this very same time. As we see pressing for a complete global interwebs control system, age verification lobby pushes for age verification checks for VPN usage. Privacy tools are being rebranded as loopholes in need of closure. You see how this word keeps reorganization came up, has been coming up, and rebranding is coming up? Yeah, just like the reorganization and rebranding going on in a Palantir panopticon Siberian gulag near you, right, Trump? Is when do-gooder badlings attack. A trade group representing companies that build age verification systems is now lobbying to extend these checks to anyone using VPN in the UK. No conflict of interest there. At your expense, the Age Verification Providers Association wants online platforms to fall under the UK censorship law, the Online Safety Act, to not only detect VPN usage, but also analyze user behavior to guess whether someone might be a minor in disguise. If flagged, users would face a prompt, prove your age, or allow a one-time geolocation to confirm you're outside the UK. According to the AVPA, this process is necessary because VPNs can mask users' actual locations, allowing them to appear as though they are in countries where age verification laws do not apply. The association points to the data showing a dramatic increase in VPN use around the time the UK's new internet rules were enforced, suggesting people are using these tools to bypass restrictions. This approach treats privacy tools as a form of defiance. Here, VPNs, once considered sensible and essential for online security, are being rebranded as suspicious. Under the new logic, using a VPN could mean you are trying to break the rules. It could, I guess. If you're presumed a criminal, if you're presumed a child. As the UK censorship machinery rolls out, AVPA wants to make sure even those trying to shield their data are pulled back into the system. And Vance and Rubio will rail against the UK and Euro cyber surveillance system, but UK tax authority to surveil social media posts. AI now quietly shadows Instagram and Facebook while deciding if citizens' taxes add up. Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, the UK equivalent of the Internal Revenue Service, has for the first time confirmed it has been using artificial intelligence to monitor social media activity and certain tax-related investigations, a revelation that intensifies concerns over how far the government is preparing to go in digitally surveilling the public. And I got to just keep interjecting, the public means government. And you are part of that. You're its property. The department says this surveillance capability is used only in criminal probes and insists that its actions are legally justified and subject to oversight. They're criminal probes. When you're presumed guilty of a crime, then everything you do doesn't sound like much of an overreach then, does it? But while HMRC claims safeguards are in place, the quiet deployment of these tools over several years raises fresh alarms about unchecked data use and creeping automation of law enforcement functions. These mission creeps, they keep identifying them. The disclosure arrives at a time when the government is accelerating its reliance on AI across multiple departments. Inside HMRC, AI systems are being woven into routine operations, not just to monitor for fraud, but also to automate correspondence, review tax filings, and deliver warnings when suspicious patterns are detected. And speaking of the future that they want, look what Trump and the compromised Congress criminals are installing against you right here at home. U.S. Treasury weighs digital ID verification and DeFi under Genius Act. Coding KYC into smart contracts threatens to turn permissionless finance into a gated system. So, there's your PATRIOT Act, KYC, rearing its ugly head to strike these many years hence, just as planned before back then. The U.S. Treasury is exploring, they say, just like I was telling you before, talking about, well, we don't know about this digital coinage, digital tokens. We don't know anything about it. Yeah, right. Keep lying some more. The U.S. Treasury is exploring whether decentralized finance, DeFi, smart contracts should include embedded digital identity checks, a move that would fundamentally alter how anonymity and privacy function in blockchain-based ecosystems. Well, it won't, will it? This initiative stems from the recent enacted guidance in establishing national innovation for U.S. stablecoins, Genius Act, which not only establishes a regulatory path for dollar-backed tokens, but also mandates that stablecoin users comply with anti-money laundering laws because you're presumed to be money launderers, including know your customer requirements. Well, they're just criminal investigations because you're all presumed criminals. There's no overreach. As part of the law's rollout, the Treasury has issued a formal request for public feedback on novel techniques to detect illicit finance involving digital assets. But what about the feedback as to the onerous and unconscionable nature of fiat that digital asset lie modernizes? Do we have some feedback for that? Can we have a channel for that discussion? One of these methods now on the table is coding identity verification directly into DeFi protocols. So easy, so convenient, folks. The options listed in the Treasury's consultation include government-issued identification, biometric data, and so-called portable digital identity credentials. Remember last episode, we were talking about Mexico? You think it's just there? You think it's just over in the UK? You think it's just in Russia? How many more places do I have to identify? Your own home. And it's not good enough, I guess, to scare the wits out of people to start saying something. And more importantly, act away to do things to stay away from it. Comments are due by October 17th. After that deadline, the Treasury will submit a report to Congress and may issue proposed rules. The backdrop to this effort is the Genius Act itself, which represents Washington's first full-scale legislative response to digital assets. The law, signed by President Donald Trump, after passing with broad bipartisan support, focuses on stablecoin digital tokens tied to the U.S. dollar and imposes new federal standards. These tokens must now be backed one-to-one by safe, liquid assets like cash or U.S. treasuries. But cash and U.S. treasuries are part of the onerous and unconscionable fiat system. The only liquid assets I know of would be melted gold or silver, which is too hot for the fiat system to touch, actually. Well, the crypto industry spent years and millions lobbying for regulatory clarity on stablecoins. The final compromise came with substantial strings attached. Under the law, permitted stablecoin issuers are now considered financial institutions for the purposes of the Bank Secrecy Act. This means that they must identify users, monitor transactions, and report activities to federal authorities, transforming them into potential surveillance nodes for the United States financial system. What did I say about third-party liability? What have I been saying about third-party liability? Despite the Genius Act, G-E-N-I-U-S is what I should be saying, and it's not about genius at all. It might be smart, but it ain't too intelligent. Act. Being a pro-innovation law, privacy advocates are raising alarms over its far-reaching implications. Public blockchains already expose all transactions, but the requirement to verify identities adds a layer of personal traceability that didn't previously exist. Once a wallet address is linked to a user's real identity, all historical and future transactions tied to that wallet become observable in full detail. Now, those of you that are interested, you have an opportunity to comment, and I suggest you do so. You've been told how to do that behind a woodshed. that the blind faith and presumption of safety gets me, that people believe that that they can buy into all this. It's quite alarming. But it's not unexpected after watching people fall for the great COVID swindle either. But look at this very carefully. You will definitely have to read that GENIUS Act, get an understanding of what they were doing with it, and make your comments to it. Who knows, you might be able to find something that's truly untoward the people and be able to make an accounting of yourself for it and your study, and be someone who then has the right to go stop it if it is anything that's of any value. If they're taking possession of a part of the market, the crypto market, they will invalidate every other part. That may be a good thing. That may be not a good thing. So we have to be very careful on what they're doing. They're moving very quickly now, as I've told you. If they embrace an outlaw, they control it. Everything else outside of that then can become an outlaw. They don't have to control it. They just put it in a cage. And with the digital gulag, it's not going to be very hard to shut you out. And there's apparently no stopping the digital gulag the government wants. As we read, the Supreme Court allows Mississippi age verification law to take effect, advancing online digital ID push. The fight over age checks is rapidly becoming a battle over the future of anonymity online. The Supreme Court choice to let Mississippi enforce its new age verification law is part of a growing shift toward digital ID requirements across the internet, raising urgent concerns about privacy and censorship. By declining to block the law while legal challenges continue, the court has effectively allowed states to begin tying online activity to users' real-world identities, a move that could reshape how people access information and speak freely online. So you think your presumption of innocence, your right not to be presumed a minor, your lawful capacity, on the other hand, would be enough to block a law violating innocence presumption, or that together with the presumption of innocence against being a delinquent youth, your First Amendment prohibition against infringement, the right not to be forced into an association, the burden of proof upon the government, not you, to show to the contrary, would be enough. And I wonder how many of these cases turn on a Turner presenting the wrong challenges and insufficient evidence to support the sustainability that their Bar Association membership guild officially promotes. Remember, that's the start of this is where the core of this whole thing is. Not the U.S. financial system, it's that global financial system into which the WEF is tied and the sustainability is tied, and the fact that the head guy at the BIS wants to know about wherever your last nickel went. Mississippi's HB 1126 requires social media platforms to verify a user's age before allowing them to create an account. Those under 18 must obtain parental permission. The platform also required to restrict access to what the state broadly labels as harmful content. They get to decide? And the Supreme Court was cool with this? For companies to comply, identity checks will be necessary, meaning users may soon need to provide government ID or other personal documents just to post or view content on public platforms. The Supreme Court has already allowed a similar Texas law to be enforced. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, writing separately from the court's unsigned order, stated that the law is likely unconstitutional and said that NetChoice had likely shown that the enforcement would violate the First Amendment. Still, the court allowed the law to take effect, saying the trade group had not shown a strong enough risk of harm to justify emergency relief. And so here's what I get back to the thing I keep saying. No harm, no foul. The presumption sits in the governments. You have to bring your harm. Find the harm that it is and make sure it's substantial. Make sure that it's particularly with a right. And bring the proof of it. Don't just bring your claim for it. This is a big statement right there. The strong enough risk. You have to overcome the presumption against the risk by bringing the evidence of it. Net choice, again, so where's the attorneys here? Where are the attorneys that didn't do this? Net choice, which includes a company such as Meta, Google, Amazon, Reddit, and Discord, argues that mandatory age checks for general purpose platforms violate free speech protections. The group had previously won a ruling to block the law, but that decision was overturned in April by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Paul Task, co-director at the Net Choice Litigation Center, said the ruling was a delay, not a defeat. Quote, although we're disappointed with the court's decision, Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence makes clear that Net Choice will ultimately succeed in defending the First Amendment, not just in this case, but across all Net Choice's ID for speech lawsuits, he said. Now remember, who'd have thunk it, that it would be so hard to have and hold something inviolate. The larger implications of the law go far beyond youth safety. It advances the infrastructures for an internet where identity is verified at the door. This kind of system connects every person, everything a person says, reads, or searches online to a name, a date of birth, and possibly a government ID. Political prisoners, folks, future homegrown, they don't like what you said. They know where you're at. They get your geolocation. I guess the drone just shows up, picks you up, takes you off if they just don't hailfire you like I told you was going to happen a long time ago. When you're traveling across a light, you go through a red light, they have your picture, they know who you are, they look at your bank account, you don't have the funds for the fine, and then they drone you out of existence before you reach the other side of the intersection. And then the street sweeper comes and cleans you up. I said that long years ago, didn't I? It also amplifies the risk of data exposure, since any breach could link personal data to specific online activity. Similar systems are already gaining ground in other countries. The United Kingdom has begun enforcing rules that ask users to confirm their age through ID cards, biometric scans, and credit card details. Although these efforts are framed as protections for children, they also create large databases of verified identity information that can be misused, leaked, repurposed for surveillance. By letting the Mississippi law proceed, the court has, at least for now, cleared the path for more states to implement similar systems. And that's correct. Your presumption of innocence and inviolate rights mean nothing in the post-founding father Lincolnized era. And that the court agrees with this usurpation as a presumption itself should interest a whole lot more people than I hear listening behind the woodshed. And relative to not being stirred, responding to an ex-Twitter post that says, warning, Canada is the WEF's ground zero. Del Bigtree sounds the alarm. The World Economic Forum's dystopian vision isn't some distant threat. It's unfolding right now in Canada. A once free nation known for its vast wilderness and liberty is now being turned into a testing ground for the global elite's control agenda. And I respond, alarm? WEF is a veneer. Canada is not ground zero. The foundations for usurpation have been in the United States for decades as well as being implemented incrementally. Go ahead, concentrate and take out WEF. Is the metastasized cancer cured? I hope you said no. See, shaking the fruit of the poison tree only identifies some of the monkeys that might fall out. But the tree remains to continue spreading its poisonous fruits and nutcases. I think we were told to not just shake the tree, but cut at the root and keep the republic. The republic of which Trump apparently has no idea about, as he helps to install the infrastructure of that final overthrow and likely conquest of America. And sadly, while the patriots watch with their pom-poms a-pumping, it's something more where the evidence may be much more quickly acquired to aid in holding officials accountable. Thousands of formerly secret files of police misconduct in California made public through searchable database. The records open a window into nearly 12,000 cases involving allegations of sexual assault to brutality complaints and incidences involving deadly force. The thousands of previously secret files on alleged police misconduct in California have now been made public through a searchable database. The Police Records Access Project database, painstakingly assembled over 7 years by journalists, activists, and data scientists, went public on Monday with documents from more than 400 government agencies across the Golden State. The records open a window into nearly 12,000 cases involving alleged police misconduct or the use of serious force, ranging from dishonesty through brutality complaints to repeated sexual harassment by officers. The database will allow researchers, journalists, members of the public, and victims of police misconduct to dig into how California cops have handled such cases, while helping defense lawyers identify officers who may have skeletons in their closet. Quote, in 2018, California had some of the most secret records in the country, so people decided to work together, Project co-founder Lisa Pickoff White told the San Francisco Chronicle, one of the news outlets providing access to the database. The records can be searched publicly online via the Chronicle, the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco broadcaster QED, or the statewide news nonprofit Cal Matters. The project has its roots in 2018 when the California State Legislature reversed decades of secrecy and mass unsealed all police records involving the use of serious force or findings of officer dishonesty or sexual assault. I need to interject here, if you don't have this in your state, it looks like this is how you go about doing that in your state to get these records unsealed and start exposing some of the officers that are violating people under the color of a badge. Another law in 2021 also unsealed all records involving findings of police discrimination, excessive force, wrongful arrests, or wrongful searches. Another thing that comes to my mind in this AI-type world coming up and database accessibility, you're going to need a bunch of weapons against those that may come against you. You get these cops that have direct access to you, can find you quickly, and they want to harass you, and they can do it digitally. You won't know that. You're going to have a way to get at people that are found to be doing that on your own as well. This becomes a very interesting battle, if you will, between we the people and the government and their agents. Journalists spent years methodically requesting documents from police departments, sheriff's departments, transit agencies, prisoners, coroner's officers, prosecutors, and oversight bodies, eventually pooling their efforts into a collective of more than 30 news outlets. Research at the Berkeley Institute for Data Science and Stanford University Big Local News Project then created a searchable database with the help of the ACLU and numerous other academic and civil society organizations, as well as funding from the State of California, the Sony Foundation, and Jay-Z's entertainment company, Roc Nation. Quote, this kind of data is necessary for even basic forms of independent oversight, project helper and data scientist Tarak Shaw said. Tiffany Bailey of the ACLU of Southern California likewise told CalMatters, quote, critically, families who have lost loved ones in California will now have direct access to information they need to seek meaningful accountability that has too often been denied. So maybe someone can scrape those sites for the data that's on those databases and repost it maybe anywhere else, somewhere else. And I think we have, relative to a supporter of the Real Liberty Media Network, thepolicerecord.com, I understand offers police identification using facial recognition. Though I think there's a monthly fee for it. You buy credits as needed, I think you do. And I understand you can also hire a search bot or rent a digital search dog that scrapes the web for information that they can find for you. And I'm not really sure all the fees there, but that's available as well if you need to. And there's also a Google. You have to go through Google, but if you need that information, I guess you have to do that. But you might want to try that out as well. That's been building, again, a great supporter of the network, trying to identify these people that come before us as cops, and really they're not really following the law at all, and we have no way to get at them. and no way to get any kind of sort of accountability where we need that evidence, right? Again, you see a number of cases in this episode. You need substantial evidence, direct connection. And I think that's fair. I mean, you can't just have haphazard statements coming up. As we see, Supreme Court gives Trump partial win on DEI health cuts. Justice split on process for challenging federal research grant reductions. The Supreme Court on Thursday gave partial approval to the Trump administration cuts to National Institutes of Health grants as part of efforts against diversity, equity, and inclusion policies. In a 5-4 decision, the justices allowed a certain funding cuts to proceed, but left in place a ruling that invalidated the guidance document that outlined the policy, leaving its future application in question. The majority did not provide detailed reasoning, but suggested that the groups opposing federal cuts pursue their challenges in the Court of Federal Claims instead of district courts. Here we have it again. Attorneys don't know where they're supposed to file their cases. The decision partially lifts a lower court ruling that declared the cancellations illegal and blocked the administration from going ahead. The NIH, which distributes billions in research grants, terminated more than 1,700 grants after review found that they did not align with Trump's directives, including projects on HIV prevention and gender identity among teenagers. 16 states and the American Public Health Association challenged the move, arguing it was unlawfully implemented. U.S. District Judge William Young found procedural violations and patterns of discrimination in the grant determinations and bluntly called it out. He ordered and blocked $783 million worth of cuts. For now, the administration can withhold the funding while the legal case plays out in court. It was the 18th time during Trump's second term that the Supreme Court has at least partially granted an emergency appeal from the administration. As New York court throws out massive fraud penalty against Trump. New York court calls a $515 million award over whether President inflated his assets excessive. An appeals court has thrown out the massive civil fraud penalty against President Trump, ruling Thursday in New York State's lawsuit accusing him of exaggerating his wealth. A panel of five judges in New York's mid-level appellate division said the verdict, which stood to cost Trump more than $550 million and rock his real estate empire, was excessive. After finding that Trump engaged in fraud by flagrantly padding financial statements that went to lenders and insurers, Judge Arthur Engoron ordered him last year to pay $355 million in penalties with interest. That sum has now topped $515 million. The total, combined with penalties levied on some other Trump Organization executives, including Trump's son Eric and Donald Jr., now exceeds $527 million with interest. Quote, while the injunctive relief ordered by the court is well-crafted to curb defendants' business culture, the court's disgorgement order, which directs the defendants pay nearly $500 million to the state of New York, is an excessive fine that violates the Eighth Amendment of the United States Constitution, Judge Diane T. Renwick and Peter H. Moulton wrote in one of the several opinions shaping the appeals court ruling. Engoron also imposed other punishments, such as banning Trump and his two eldest sons from serving in corporate leadership for a few years. Those provisions have been on pause during the Trump's appeal, and he was able to hold off collection of the amount by posting a $175 million bond. The court, which was split on the merits of the lawsuit, and the lower court's fraud finding dismissed the penalty Engoron imposed in its entirety, while also leaving a pathway for further appeals to state court's highest court, the Court of Appeals. The appeals court, the appellate division of the state's trial court, took an unusually long time to rule, weighing Trump's appeal for nearly 11 months after oral arguments last fall. Normally, appeals are decided in a matter of weeks or a few months. New York Attorney General Letitia James, who brought the suit on the state's behalf, has said that the businessman turned politician engaged in lying, cheating, and staggering fraud. Her office had no immediate comment after Thursday's decision. No different than the Alex Jones judgment. Shocking outcomes, but you see the courts are there. I don't know the validity of this. I don't know what the upper court's going to say. But again, I read these to say, to show and explain, if you're into these, if you get yourself in trouble, look and understand how to do appeals and look and listen to these cases to see what they use in order to challenge the lower courts. And you just move your case along that way. And I've told you before, look to the appeal. I've seen enough injustice. The lower court is where I make my record and make sure my record's made in all the things I'm going to appeal to. A lot of times you can thwart a case that way because they know that it's going to be embarrassing for the judge down below, but sometimes you can't. And so you want to make your record as good as possible. You do all the due process steps you can do. And so that's why I read some of these things. In these reports, you can see what was argued and how to go about asserting those. It doesn't have to be a $550 million penalty case. It could be a traffic ticket. And as I say that, I remind people, you need to read all your laws relative to criminal procedure. I know it's boring and all that. It doesn't seem to make sense. But if you're not familiar with that, when it comes down on you, it's a lot of work to try and make up in a short time. That helping people, I realized again, helping people, that it's very, very difficult in a short order to do the things due process-wise to make your right record when you don't have the heads up on what to expect. So do that for yourself as well, as I'm reading all these give and takes of the courts, how they're doing it, what they're doing, what's going on. And so you can hear, it's not just a win for the government. It's only when you step up and protect yourself is when the questions can actually be brought public. As we've been reading what Trump has wanted to do, he's got 18 different suits that he's had to go up to the Supreme Court emergency orders. And he's only partially victorious, which means he's been illegal that many times. He's been having to actually have to fight these things and maybe lose, even though he come back along and he did an appeal and he won. At least got his putative parts done. But he's coming after us, it seems. And without any real authority. Chicago is probably next to see federal troops. Chicago may be getting the D.C. treatment next. President Trump on Friday suggested that he planned to send the federal troops to various U.S. cities using the same model as what's been happening in Washington, as I reported last episode. And it said he was talking about. I highlighted that word a number of times. That's predicting the future. He wasn't messing around. He wasn't talking out the side just for jokes. Trump told reporters, I think Chicago will be our next, and then we'll go over and help New York. Just as that news gave us notice when Trump's kingdom had in store to help us through this Lincolnized and Patriot Act modified world that we live in anymore. Just as you've been told behind the woodshed. So even if he is challenged, the incremental federal mission creep is furthered. All the while we the people watch pom-poms a-pumping. It's really startling to me. Hegseth fires top Pentagon intelligence official. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth has dismissed Lieutenant General Jeffrey Cruz, Director of Defense Intelligence Agency, in a move officials attributed Friday as a loss of confidence. The firing continues the Trump administration's purge of top national security officials. Cruz oversaw the agency's preliminary assessment that the U.S. airstrike badly damaged but did not destroy nuclear sites in Iran. That infuriated President Trump, who insisted the attack had obliterated the targets. The top Democrat and Senate Intelligence Committee immediately criticized the dismissal of Cruz by saying that the firing of yet another senior national security official underscores the Trump administration's dangerous habit of treating intelligence as a loyalty test rather than a safeguard for our country, Senator Mark Warner said in a statement. So yes, remember Ghislaine saying all the right things. We can almost hear the pardon pen scratching on the paper right now, if you will. But yes, the woke right is as dangerous as the woke left in the ongoing uniparty overthrow of the republic that we, the people, failed to yet keep. General Cruz, as a career military officer, with decades of distinguished nonpartisan service to our nation, making his ouster all the more troubling. And what about the government ouster of all the veterans that gave nonpartisan service to our nation as they seek help or are committing suicide? Seems par for the course of the treatment of the people it is to serve more than serve up. But GI, don't you know? This has been BTWRLM 642, and I'll be with you next week, Tech Diffs, for Nature Willing.
Echoes call, the hour is near, behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three, Hal's voice rolls like thunder, fierce and free. Pull up a chair, lean in close, listen to learn, dose by dose, behind the woodshed.
Next week, heed the call, behind the woodshed standing tall.